Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which now offers a graduate business track in sports management. With input from senior executives in pro sports, Carthage designed this master's program to align with employer needs. More at carthage.edu/graduate. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The following morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2006. Enjoy. I could hardly put down a remarkable new book which I have been reading called Miracles on the Water, The Heroic Survivors of a World War II U-Boat Attack. And this is a story which I had never heard anything at all about. And I know something about the Second World War, and I've talked to several people who thought they really knew this period quite thoroughly, and yet one way or another had somehow not come to know this remarkable story of tragedy and courage. The story is told beautifully by Tom Nagorski, senior broadcast producer for ABC's World News Tonight. And the book Miracles on the Water is published by Hyperion. And Tom Nagorski, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the personal way in which this story intersects with your own life and how you came to know about this remarkable moment in history.
Well, it began as a family story for me, oddly enough. I was probably a young teenager maybe when I first heard about it via my great uncle, who was at the time a man in his early 80s. And I knew vaguely through him that he'd been at sea, had a horrible ordeal at sea. He'd been on a ship that was sunk and then left out on a lifeboat and given up for dead, along with a great many other people who were in his boat. And the punchline to that story was that he'd come back alive to find his own obituary in several newspapers, and the same went for his fellow passengers. What I never knew at the time when I was young was that my great uncle's story really, the larger tapestry version of it, involved a large group of children who had been on that same ship, who were part of an evacuation program for kids leaving England as the war became tougher and the bombardment of London and other cities intensified in the summer and fall of 1940.
You said that the story, as it came to you early on when you were still a teenager, came to you in patchy fashion, snippets tossed across the dinner table. And we can well imagine how a story like this would not really fully sink in. I mean, just how important it was, what a momentous experience this was for your uncle. You're fortunate, of course, to have had the experience of in a sense, sort of rescuing from a sort of oblivion many of the remarkable details about this story. Tell us how much or how thoroughly this story has been told before now, and how you went about finding out still more about exactly what happened.
Well, the first thing I did would answer both your questions. The first thing I did was go back into the archives and find newspaper accounts at the time, some of which my great uncle's daughters, who are still living today, had tucked away. And you can see that at the time, this is September 1940, it was a huge story. It was front page news not only in England, in Canada, where those kids were, that was their ultimate destination, and in this country as well, front page news in many of the major newspapers, both when the ship was torpedoed and then when some of the remarkable rescues were carried out, which I write about in the book. But I think, you know, back to your opening remarks about the war and how we can all feel, I certainly consider myself a pretty good amateur student of World War II. You know, we have to understand that that conflict, lasting as long as it did, produced so many, I guess what you might call small epics, if that's not a contradiction in terms, that, you know, one after another. And perhaps that's why it stands to reason that that some of those, you know, remarkable stories that were sort of over after a few weeks or a month. In this case, the trauma and the drama that was described in those newspapers and by the survivors when they returned home, I think was probably eclipsed even in Great Britain and certainly in the rest of the world as the war marched on, as the battle lines shifted, and there was so much else to be concerned about, afraid of. You will find stories like this that were enormously impactful at the time, and then just drifted off, I suppose, for whatever reason.
Hmm. Although, one would think it would almost take something like a world war to erase the impact of a story as powerful as this one.
Right.
We're speaking with Tom Nagorski about his book, Miracles on the Water. I appreciate the fact that in your book you take plenty of time to set the context of British families deciding to send their children off to the presumed safety of Canada. And you really help us understand what drove some British families to do this and what a wrenching decision it was. That's a powerful story in and of itself. It makes us wonder what each of us would do were we placed in the same awful situation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, and wrenching is the word. I mean, before one gets to the stories of what actually happened out on the water, you can't help. I'm a parent of two young children, and you can't help but at least attempt to imagine yourself in those circumstances, even if you can't really. The choice was stark and in a way simple.
Hmm.
Do you keep your family together as we probably most of us would be inclined to do, even as the bombing intensifies, and really as a sort of the aerial bombardment produced, as we know, a reign of terror at that period in Great Britain, and in some cases you had people whose homes or whose neighbors' homes had actually been flat out destroyed. Do you wait that out or attempt to wait it out as a family unit, or do you take the government up on an offer to send your children? They had to be between the ages of 5 and 15 to presumed safety to another country where families were waiting and willing to take them in, but you didn't know very much about those families. In some cases, you didn't even know what city they'd wind up in. And it was for, quote-unquote, the duration of the war. And as we know, at that point, even Winston Churchill couldn't guess what that time frame might really involve. So it's a terribly stark decision. We do know that thousands of British families took the government up on the offer and sent their boys and girls off on these ships to other lands.
Hmm. You mentioned at one point that part of the reason for this was the idea that this would somehow be for the good of the nation. I mean, not just for the sake of the safety of the children, but to help preserve a better future for England by not allowing too many of its young people to perish. I love, however, the statement you quote from an author named Elsbeth Huxley when she writes, security for the young and helpless was measured against the scars which flight from danger might have upon their minds and against the bereavement which parents would suffer with their children gone.
Yeah, well, I use that quote because sometimes, your own words can't really measure up to what someone else wrote at the time, and she put it very, very well. It was a very controversial thing, mind you. The opinion you cite that it was for the good of the nation to safeguard these children sounds eminently reasonable, and then you hear what Winston Churchill had to say about it, and he was... to the extent we know, he was fairly vigilant in his opposition to this idea initially. He felt it sent a terrible message, I guess propaganda-wise, for lack of a better word, to the country and to the rest of the world and to the Germans, because it you would have unavoidably pictures of children lined up on ships fleeing the country, and even if they all had smiles on their faces, stiff upper lip, and all the rest, it looked like defeatism to him. And he thought it showed no spine, no backbone, and it was better, he felt, to try to encourage families to keep their children in the country.
In the end, for this ship called the City of Benares, 90 such children went aboard, along with a number of regular paying passengers and, of course, crew as well, for a total of, I think, just over 400 aboard this ship. And the City of Benares was not alone. It traveled in a convoy. Help our listeners explain the convoy system and how, in a sense, it failed the passengers of the City of Benares, at least.
Well, the convoys had been put in place. They're actually an old naval tradition, but the British had begun using them anytime, really, any liners of any significance left a British port for protection. And the general rule was you clumped a bunch of smaller and larger craft together. And once you set them up, you gave them the protection of usually a British destroyer, a Royal Navy vessel out front, with a couple of smaller, in this case what they called corvettes, smaller Royal Navy vessels, and sometimes some aerial cover as well. And it was a deterrent. The destroyers could scan for submarines. They could also drop depth charges to repel submarines. And it was the way you felt you gave some clearance and safety to ships that were moving out. I should also say for your listeners that a reminder that at the time Hitler's submarine war against Great Britain, his effort to enforce a full naval blockade was in full gear. They'd sunk a whole bunch of ships that summer, so this convoy system was deemed necessary. And as to how it failed in this case. This convoy, which the ship carrying the children was at the lead of, was escorted by the Royal Navy about 500 miles out into the North Atlantic, and that was deemed to be the point at which there was smooth sailing, so to speak, that the submarines weren't operating that far out. And that was, as I lay out in the book, that was a terribly bad assumption, a miscalculation. They were going further than that. And about 130 miles further out, with the escort gone, the City of Benares was torpedoed in the middle of the night.
Hmm. And at that moment, utterly alone. We should mention also the fact that even if it had been torpedoed with those convoy vessels around them, the convoy ships were shields and nothing more. In fact, those ships' captains were under strict orders not to attempt rescue unless an attacking U-boat had been chased away or destroyed.
That's right. There's a fish in a barrel quality to this. That you submarines were known if they found liners without any cover, they'd just go for everything that was out there. And indeed, they actually hit another one nearby. So,
The impact of those torpedoes it's actually one torpedo. I think you tell us of two torpedoes being fired and missing.
That's correct.
And then a third torpedo which hits the target perfectly, and. Of course, a few people were probably instantly killed in that impact or shortly thereafter. What is really quite extraordinary is what occurs with some of the lifeboats being deployed, the lowering of the lifeboats or the landing of the boats. This is something we just don't stop to think about, as you say, the great skill and good fortune, even on a sunny day, to successfully deploy a lifeboat, let alone on stormy seas in this kind of chaos. Tell us just a bit about what occurred in these awful moments as the lifeboats were first deployed.
Yeah, well, as somebody said to me the other day who just finished the book, it's sort of the opposite problems that the Titanic faced, if you will, where there was all sorts of I think human error cited, and frigid water and all the like. Here you had a ship that went down so fast. It's 31 minutes from torpedoes impact to sinking. It was listing or bent, if you will, almost within minutes of the torpedoes impact. And what you had were lifeboats that, although they'd done the drills almost every day that they'd been out on the water, as you say, the task of lowering a boat, a lifeboat, when the ship is slanted that way, in this case there were heavy winds as well, is extremely difficult. And you have to, the best explanation I was given, and I use it in the book, is like trying to sort out a very clunky set of Venetian blinds that won't level off, because if you do it, if you lower the boat level with the ship, you're going to be tilted just like the ship is, and you're not going to come down cleanly. And boat after boat was hampered by the fact that waves threw more water into the boat. And so from the get-go, and we're talking 10:30 at night when the ship sinks, you had a dozen lifeboats deployed to the water in some cases very, very compromised positions with lots of them were waterlogged, a couple of them actually flipped. So it was in that surrounding, if you will, and that this ordeal began, and it's really why the survival of any of those people is such a miracle.
Especially tragic is what occurs with Lifeboat 8, which ends up in this chaos, dropping to a near vertical position, pitching more than 30 people, and most of them children, into the water. Early in the book, we are told the story of the Grimmond family. We're even shown a photograph of them picking through the rubble of their home, which had been destroyed in a German attack. And unfortunately, three of those Grimmond children were in this ill-fated 8th lifeboat. You say in a single week, the Grimmond children had lost their home, raced to enlist in the evacuee program, traveled at the last minute to Liverpool, and won the admiration of children and adults alike on board the Benares. Gussie Grimmond had charmed virtually everyone she met in that short, eventful time. Now, in a few awful moments, Gussie, Constance, and Violet Grimmond had been thrown into the North Atlantic and washed away. And not just them. Others suffered a similar terrible fate.
Yeah, I mean, I must tell you that at the outset, I wrote this book primarily because I was so inspired by the bravery of children and the courage and discipline shown by those who survived. There are some, and you've just described perhaps the most profound of them, some terribly tragic stories. And in particular, here were, when we get back to the wrenching choice that families had made, this was a family that had decided to send all its children who were of the eligible age on this ship, and who had done so for a very understandable reason. Their house had been blown to bits in the outskirts of London, and so it was a particularly tough thing to read about, to write about. I should tell you that some of the surviving siblings of that family are still around today. And it's a wrenching thing for them to relive. Some of them were too young to really understand it at the time.
This is a story of, as you just said, remarkable courage and ingenuity and valor and compassion and generosity. And one of the most stirring figures of all is one of the adult escorts for these children, someone by the name of Michael Rennie. Just tell our listeners a little bit about Michael Rennie and why he shines so radiantly in the midst of this story.
Well, Michael Rennie was by all accounts, a very gifted student, athlete. He was a rugby star in England. He was in his early 20s. He was one of a small group of escorts for the children. These were young men and women who were volunteers, basically, to be in charge of a group of boys or girls, and Rennie was universally loved, it seemed, by the children there. At any rate, he was in again one of the more compromised lifeboats, compromised is an understatement. Several of those kids in the boat were thrown to the water, Michael Rennie, who was a very physically strong young guy, just started diving to the water. A few people, including crew members, had tried to just sort of reach over the lifeboat and bring people who were in the water into the boat. He was too impatient and too afraid that they were going to lose these kids. And one by one, he just starts diving, swimming, getting a child, bringing them back. Sees another, dives, heads out, finds a child, brings them back. It's very difficult to imagine, but I know that the waters were rough. These are lifeboats with sturdy and tall sides to them, just to climb back in, much less raise a child over the side, is no small feat. He did this, by all accounts, about a dozen times. One of the most stirring things I found in my research was I visited a church on the outskirts of London where Michael Rennie's father was the vicar, and where there is in a corner over an altar a lovely small mural painting that depicts the scene that I've just described. It's a tribute to Michael Rennie, who in the end did not make it himself.
Among many other extraordinary stories of courage is that of two young women, Bess Walder and Beth Cummings, who actually find themselves not in the relative safety of a lifeboat, but actually either clinging to a raft or an overturned boat or something like that.
Yeah, no, their lifeboat had flipped. And these are, as I said, these are not small boats. But their boat flips. It's sitting there bobbing along. They and some of the other occupants made their way back to the boat. They were absolutely unable to turn it back over. So these two girls, they were 14 and 15 at the time, they climb onto the sides, essentially getting their hands onto the keel, or the sort of underbelly of the lifeboat, and they hang on. And again, I won't spoil too much of the story, but they basically, through physical fortitude, and actually an incredible amount of mental strength as well, lasted the better part of 18 hours. And the thing that was so extraordinary to me about them, and I should tell you, I guess I am spoiling part of the story, that Bess and Beth, I'm happy to report, are alive today. They said immediately after their rescue, and they still say the same today, that they survived because they saw the other one hanging on, and they were afraid if Bess said, if I let go, I was convinced Beth would let go. Beth says, if I let go, I thought she would, because they just, even as they were weary beyond belief and their hands, this is now going, later into the next day, their hands practically frozen to the keel, they almost would have been content to let go. They were about ready to give up themselves, but they each thought, if I let go, the other will go. Mm. And that sort of selflessness and courage, these are the kinds of things that inspired me to write the book in the first place.
Also, I think a remarkable moment in that story is early on when they realize that there are other passengers who were aboard that lifeboat who have also made their way but are on the other side and hidden from view save for their hands up on the keel. And you talk of how Beth Cummings noticed one of those pairs of hands seemed to be kind of thin and elegant, very slim fingers, so probably belonging to maybe an older woman.
Right.
And she saw the jewels on her hands, one diamond ring in particular, small and dazzling and utterly out of place, it seemed, a bizarre glimmer of beauty amid the horror and the storm. And, of course, before too long, those hands disappear. And one by one, those passengers hanging for dear life on the other side can hang on no longer. The story is also, for one of the lifeboats, a much longer story than the others. And we are brought into kind of the drama and almost the theater of how one maintains sanity for days upon days upon days in the confines of a lifeboat. And it's remarkable how one of the female escorts, a woman named Mary Cornish, who's, by no means the standard sort of picture we have of a heroine,
right,
is so courageous in keeping up the spirits of the boys that are in her boat, and that they turn to things like song and storytelling to maintain their grip on reality and their sanity. It's just remarkable to think of what we turn to in our direst moments of need.
Yeah. She basically took the strategy that what these children in the boat would need was diversion, that the crewmen would take care of food and water to the extent they could. But you had, in her case, six young, energetic, restless English boys. And, she just figured they're going to go mad if I don't give them something to think about other than you know, the barren and really miserable and perhaps life-threatening situation that they're confronted with. She did a masterful job with that, and every one of those children credited her in a large way with preserving both their sanity and in some way saving their lives.
Hmm. And at one point in the midst of all this, I think it is your uncle who thinks to himself, in the fact that they have preserved themselves for so long, we have done something remarkable. Yeah. That is certainly putting it mildly.
Yeah, and you know, he was a modest man. I knew him, as I said at the outset, I knew him late in his life. He was certainly not one given to anything approaching, you know, boastfulness. But that's an understatement. He did something remarkable. Those kids did something I certainly will never forget. And almost everyone in their own way, whether it was outright acts of courage or just smarts or just, in the case of the kids, keeping their composure and not panicking when the reaction you would have expected would have been panic.
Right. Well, and the fact that at least in the early going of this ordeal, for many of the children, what seemed to power them was what you call a stimulant. Their stimulant was the powerful pull of adventure.
Sure.
I mean, and of course, in this story is that element of adventure, awful though this adventure turned out to be. At the start of the book, two things are exceptionally remarkable. One of them is a map of the North Atlantic, where we see exactly that point in the ocean mm-hmm. where the boat goes down. And that, in a nutshell, shows us the ordeal of these people so far from land. You also mentioned early on that a very good friend of yours offered you warm encouragement for the gathering of this story, someone named Peter Jennings.
That's right. That's right. I'm talking to you actually just next door to his old office. He was a great friend and colleague, and I showed him a book proposal. It goes back almost 5 years now. And he gave me all sorts of edits, but primarily he gave me great enthusiasm and encouragement, and he said, look, this is a great story, now go and make a great book.
Which you have done. The book, again, is Miracles on the Water, The Heroic Survivors of a World War II U-Boat Attack, published by Hyperion. Its author, Tom Nagorski. Tom Nagorski, I thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for talking about it today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
And now for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we will be hearing a powerful and poignant story of a refugee in the Holocaust, but a story very different from most such stories. The guest that I'm speaking to is Michal Dekel, and it is her father who actually, in a sense, fled the Holocaust, but in a pathway very different. He was born and raised in Poland, but ultimately found his way to Iran and would be one of some 1,000 Polish children who were known as the Tehran children. And his long journey and harrowing journey and experience is told in a very intriguing and fascinating book called Tehran Children, A Holocaust Refugee Odyssey. Michal Dekel is a professor of English at City College of New York, and before this, author of The Universal Jew, Masculinity, Modernity, and the Zionist Movement. And this latest book is published by W.W. Norton and Company. Michal Dekel, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much.
You tell us in the book that your father was, in some respects, distant. Not that he wasn't a loving father, but he was not necessarily forthcoming about his life's experience. And so you knew relatively little about his wartime experience. Tell us how you came to understand more about what he had experienced, because that, of course, is, in a sense, a gateway to you writing this book.
That's right. Yes. So my father was a quiet, distant, somewhat enigmatic, somewhat depressive man. He never spoke about his wartime experiences or about his pre-war life. I was born and raised in Israel. He was my Israeli father. I didn't really know anything beyond that. In 2007, about 14 years after he died, I was talking to an Iranian colleague of mine at City College, and the colleague, Salar Abdo, asked me if I knew anything about children who were Holocaust refugees in Iran. I said, yes, my father was such a refugee, but I didn't know much more than that. And that initial conversation is what spurred the book that has now been published a month ago. So that's how the research started, and of course it took about a decade to find out all the details of this journey.
You tell us that he had said that much, that he was one of the so-called Tehran children, but that when you heard him refer to himself as one of the Tehran children, you never really thought of Tehran as a place. I mean, you obviously knew there was such a place named Tehran, but somehow you never really understood sort of the implications of that name.
That's right. And not only did I not understand the implications of that name, I didn't even think about my father as a Holocaust survivor, nor did he refer to himself as a Holocaust survivor. And this is not just my father, and this is not just even the 1,000 children who came with him. This is all the Polish Jewish refugees who, as you said, fled Nazi-occupied Poland into the Soviet Union and died or survived in the Soviet Union, in Central Asia, in Iran, India, mandatory Palestine, Lebanon, and so on. So these people were not considered Holocaust survivors. As far as Tehran went, yes, I didn't really think of Tehran as a place where my father lived during the war. I just thought of it as a sort of place of transit. I imagined his journey almost in a kind of fantastical way, his journey from Poland to Palestine through Tehran as something that was very instant. And in fact, I discovered that it was a 3.5-year long journey in which they traveled through half the world. They lived in Tehran for 7 months. And so it was an actual place, of course.
Right, and that ultimate journey from Poland to Iran, 5,000 miles that we are talking about. So an extraordinary journey in many respects. One of the most fascinating things in your book is when you tell us about the many written accounts that were gathered by to gather together the stories of these Tehran children. I mean, it was a very concerted effort, and one is certainly grateful for that, or otherwise many of these stories would be ultimately lost. Tell us more about the careful process by which many of these stories were gathered and your long journey before you finally were able to uncover your father's own account of this experience.
Yes. So Poland, in 1939, Poland was became occupied both by the German forces and Soviet forces. So technically, Poland as a nation state no longer existed at the time. In London convened what we call the Polish government in exile. And that government very quickly decided that it would gather the testimonies of Polish citizens, Christian and Jewish, who were in the USSR and other places, and they were collecting this in part in order to have proof of atrocities that Polish citizens experienced in the Soviet Union, and in part to have a record of this exile. So as part of this concerted effort, they also interviewed these Tehran children when they arrived to Palestine. They also interviewed some people in Iran. And those testimonies, even though they were gathered, for somewhat of a propaganda purpose ended up being wonderful sources of information for me and for other people researching this. My father's testimony, so I knew my father's testimony existed. I thought that all the testimonies were stored at the Hoover Institute in Stanford, but I did not find my father's testimony there. I was there twice. I worked very hard. I couldn't find it. One day, I was at a conference listening to a scholar talk about children's war testimonies, and that scholar quoted from my father's testimony. I was shocked, of course, and asked her where she got the testimony. She said, from a small archive in an ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. I wrote them. Immediately, I got my father's testimony. It turned out that my father gave the testimony in Yiddish, not in Polish, and for whatever reason, it was stored in this particular, very small, off-the-beaten-path archive. So I was able to retrieve that. I was able to retrieve my father's account of his journey.
And that, of course, had to be a thrilling discovery for you, because without that, there was no way for you to know as many specifics as you did. And that ultimately, of course, allowed you to retrace your father's steps, at least to a large degree. One of the most moving aspects of this story is that it is not only the story of your father, but of his father and his father's brother. So this would be your grandfather and your great uncle. And in your words, this is an often repeated story, the tale of two brothers who had made two choices during the war. One had made the wrong choice to return to Nazi-controlled Poland, yet survived, and the other had made the right choice to remain in the Soviet Union and did not survive. It offered a grim moral lesson, the understanding of life as fundamentally ironic. Can you say a word about this aspect of your family's story?
Yes. So my family, my father's family, was a very large clan that lived in a town in Poland called Ostrowiecka. September 1939, when the war begins, that entire clan, or a big part of it, flees to the Soviet side. Part of that clan, my great uncle's family, remains on the Soviet border, just kind of on those towns on the Soviet border. My father's family decides that it's going to return to the German side. As punishment, the Soviets deport my father's family to Arkhangelsk, into Siberia, basically. In 1941, the Germans invade the Soviet Union, basically murder or ghettoize and later murder those Jews who are right on the border, including my great uncle and his family. The Jews that were deported as punishment for making, as I say, the stupid decision of wanting to return to Germany or to Poland, to German-occupied Poland, are released and, in fact, saved by their deportations, because the Nazis don't get that far into the Soviet interior in order to murder them. So this is the incident that I'm talking about, and it's not just my family. This is the story of many families in this situation.
And, of course, it is one of those cases in which one is confronted by nearly impossible choices. And in so many cases, these are choices in which people are making the choices with little, if any, meaningful information whatsoever. And one realizes that ultimately these choices were so capricious in nature, and whether or not one survived or not often had very little to do with one's own intelligence or good judgment. It was just impossible to know what choice to make in such an impossibly terrible situation. It must have been hard for you to think about your father and his family confronting something so awful.
Yes, that's absolutely right. As I said before, when I started out, I kind of had this fantasy, I guess, of a very quick journey somehow. But this journey was a long, arduous, arbitrary path of suffering. And as you said, at every moment, there is a decision to be made between bad and worse. are we going to go with the Soviets or are we going to go with the Germans? My family already experienced both a Soviet and a German occupation during World War I, and they survived the German occupation, so maybe the Germans will be okay this time. Then there are other decisions along the way. Do we separate from our children and send them alone to Iran, or do we keep them with us in Soviet Central Asia and possibly we all perish from starvation? There's a lot of agency. And many decisions to be made. But I was also impressed by the way the family stuck together, the way the family were there for each other. It was very moving as well.
So you end up retracing, at least to a large extent, your father's long journey as a refugee. And one of the most striking things that you discover is that there are certain places, including the village where that family lived and made their fortune, in which, in a sense, all traces of the Jewish population that once lived there have been wiped clean. And other places where this story, in a sense, is properly remembered and memorialized. Talk for a moment about that striking difference that you found as you retraced your father's path as a refugee.
Right. So the book, as you just said, is not just about the past. It's also about the present, because in the book, I travel to Poland, to Russia, to Uzbekistan, to Israel. A colleague of mine travels to Iran. So the book is also about the politics of remembrance, how the story is remembered in each one of those places. And in Poland, in my father's hometown, there are no traces of the family or of Jewish life. Actually, now there are some attempts to rebuild some of those traces, but when I visited, it was not there. In Russia, there is not exactly any memorialization of the no official memorialization of the deportations. There are some grassroots memorials. In Uzbekistan, I ended up going to the little village where my family had been, and the Uzbek farmers who'd lived there said, "We remember your ancestors. We pray for them each year. We remember how hungry they were. We remember that they ate live frogs, and we sort of prayed together," and that was a very moving moment. So, yes, remembrance is a national thing, right? Remembrance is a national thing. Nations do collective memory. And this is a transnational story. So in some ways, it kind of falls between the chairs, as many refugee stories do. My story, my book, tries to connect the dots between all these different nations and in itself become a kind of memorial for these refugees.
What do you want to say about your father's experience in Tehran when he was ultimately able to reach that far-off destination, about the experience that he had there?
The initial experience when the refugees arrive in Tehran or in Iran, in Pahlavi, which is a port in northern Iran, is very positive. Iran is the first nation that they encounter that hasn't been ravaged by war. It has bread. It has cars. It seems to the children pretty modern. And they're very warmly received by the Persian population. That's the initial stage. Later on, they are interned in a big Polish refugee camp. The children are interned in a kind of special Jewish home within that camp. The local Jewish population rallies in. Jewish population of Palestine helps them and so on. So then they kind of come under the care of Jewish organizations. So ultimately, the experience in Iran was very positive. At the end, after a number of months, there is a kind of outcry against the refugees, as we see today in many countries, because prices are going up, prices of bread are going up and so on, and they end up having to leave. But ultimately, it's a pretty positive experience.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And of course, it's a story that so many of us in the West do not know at all.
That's right.
I want you to explain an intriguing line early in the book when you are talking about your father's experience in his childhood before this horror envelops them. In this chapter, you say at one point, Poland was a wound, my father's, my aunt's, and mine by inheritance. What do you mean by Poland being a wound? And did the experience of following your father's journey, in a sense, do anything to heal that wound for you?
Yes. The reason I say Poland is a wound, because as I realized, Poland was my father's family home for 8 generations. That's a long time. They were rooted in Poland. They were wealthy. They were a large clan. So being, having to leave and basically having that life end so abruptly was a wound that my father didn't want to talk about Poland. My aunt, when I would ask her what happened, she would just say, forget about it. Following my journey, I do feel somewhat differently. I appreciate the long life that they had there and the complex life, but not only they, but the Jewish population of Poland. At the same time, it is complicated. It is complicated because in the 1930s, there was a great deal of anti-Semitism leading up to the war. Of course, during the Nazi occupation, the situation is terrible in Poland was terrible, and we know that 90% of Polish Jews perished. There is something still very very eerie, of course, about that experience. But at the same time, I traveled to Poland. I now have Polish friends. I feel like my relationship to Poland is definitely normalized.
Hmm. And I'm sure that as you followed your father's journey as a refugee, it probably makes you think maybe in different terms than you ever did before about the plight of refugees today, and especially the plight of children who find themselves refugees fleeing for their lives for one reason or another.
Yes, absolutely. And a number of people who have read my book have written me and said that now we understand the refugee experience. So I think though my book is about the Holocaust and 1940s, it is also about the universal refugee experience. And yes, absolutely, the arbitrariness, the randomness, those tough decisions that you have to make, also the way refugees make a home. What is a point of transit for many becomes an end point for many others. In other words, you're fleeing from something. You're not necessarily fleeing to something, towards something. And, I had always thought of my father as fleeing from Poland to Palestine. But, in fact, people stayed everywhere along the route. People stayed even in Siberia. People stayed in Uzbekistan. People stayed in Iran. And they became Uzbeks or Russian or Iranian. The plight, the decisions that my father, that refugees have to make, really resonate with me today, and especially children. My father was separated from his parents when he was sent from Central Asia to Iran. That separation, I think, was probably the most traumatic part of the entire journey, and this is a very traumatic journey, as you saw. So I think, for example, the fact that we're inflicting separation on children today unnecessarily is really, it's just terrible.
The book is Tehran Children, A Holocaust Refugee Odyssey, published by W.W. Norton & Company. The author, Michal Dekel. Michal Dekel, thank you for writing this extraordinary book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was honored to
speak
with you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tomorrow we speak with Rosemary Day, the author of Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Health Care. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu.